before we cut our cords, and streaming was years away. You could only binge on old DVDs, and seasons didn't last one day. But how did we cope? The weekly wait was such a tease. With the 2-hour block of shows, we could endure with ease. On every Thursday, could tune into NBC. Travel to Dundee, Mifflin, Greendale, TGS, San Pawnee. They stopped calling him a sea, but it was still a beautiful sight. So now I'm talking Comedy Night, and it's Podcasted Right.
Welcome back to Comedy Night, Podcasted Right. And this year for Halloween, I'm going as Matt Cale. Yeah, it's April, but today's episode is all about Halloween, because we're going all the way back to October 29th, 2009. Tonight, we will be discussing Community, Season 1, Episode 7, Introduction to Statistics. Parks and Recreation, Season 2, Episode 7, Greg Pakaitis. The Office, Season 6, Episode 8, Koi Pond. And 30 Rock, Season 4, Episode 3, Stone Mountain. And since these all aired in the last week of October, we are getting 4 Halloween episodes. Kind of. We'll get to that later. I obviously have an abundance of nostalgia for television, and nights like tonight were why. How could you not get excited for Halloween when all of your favorite television characters were celebrating themselves? And usually, you'd see some character making some sort of topical joke with their costume, and it was just always this fun Easter egg to look for. What was my Halloween costume in 2009? I don't think I had one, to be honest. This was in the middle of a 3-year stretch where Halloween went from Friday to Saturday to Sunday, and I was working night shift on all of them. So other than sometimes dressing up to hand out candy, I probably haven't gone to a Halloween party since like 2008. But I want to hear from you. Do you remember what you wore on Halloween 2009? There's so many ways to get in touch with me. On Twitter, at Comedy Night Pod 1. On Instagram, Comedy Night Podcasted Right. You can even now find me on Reddit as user Comedy Night Podcast. And I've also made a subreddit at reddit.com/r/ComedyNightPodRight. It's all one word. If you've got memes or thoughts on the show or anything tangentially related to any of those shows, post it on there. And you can always reach out to me directly at comedynightpodcastedright@gmail.com. Especially those of you who are early adopters and listening here and now in April 2021. I'd love any feedback you have to give. Are there segments you skip? Do I make annoying sounds? Should I auto-tune my theme song? In all honesty, you can help me make this into the best show possible. I know I usually give a podcast about 3 or 4 episodes to figure its own shit out before I bail on it. So if you're liking the show, but just wish I'd changed something, please let me know and I'd love to try to accommodate it. So today's episode is going to be extra spooky. Okay, no, actually, maybe I'm going for scary instead of spooky. Okay, actually, instead of scary, we'll be talking about the quasi-existential crisis that happens when you find out that artists that you loved turned out to be monsters in real life, and you now have to grapple with trying to separate what they did for entertainment to what they did to other people. How's that for a scary twist? Did you see that coming? Don't worry. We'll process our mixed emotions together. At this point, I've spent like 30 hours in preparation for this episode, and I'm still trying to distill all my thoughts and emotions about it into one 75 to 90 minute runtime. So enough with all this preamble, let's get down to it.
This is the Comedy Night Podcasted Right Olds. If it was new, we call it news, but it's old, so we call it olds.
I'm trying to keep this segment lighthearted. I've been talking about Balloon Boy and Windows Vista, but 3 weeks in and I've hit a brick wall. Until now, I've completely avoided talking about one of the biggest news events of 2009, mostly because it happened back in the summer, before any of these shows started airing. But with everything else that will happen in tonight's episode, this is it. I think the time's as right as it ever will be to talk about it, because one day earlier, on October 28th, 2009, a new movie was released. Michael Jackson's This Is It. Jackson had died 4 months earlier, on June 28th. If you weren't around, this was a around-the-clock media circus. If you remember back to 2 weeks ago when I played the drop of Jim talking about noteworthy news events, he listed two examples, Balloon Boy and Michael Jackson's funeral. 31 million people watched his funeral service, which was aired on over 18 different networks. How did this become such a big news story? Well, everything about Michael in the last 10 years of his life dominated headlines. And he was only 50 years old, and there was no news that he had been ill, so it was a complete shock. And he was in the middle of staging a massive comeback. He was preparing for a concert series at the O2 Arena in London, and it was called This Is It. Despite the controversy surrounding his life, Jackson still had plenty of devoted fans. But he was also the subject of constant ridicule in the media and tabloids. This moment in time isn't that far removed from when he was acquitted from molestation charges in 2005. There was absolutely no public consensus on what to make of him. He was never found guilty, but just my opinion in this case, where there's this much smoke, there's a raging fire. The more you learned about his life, he was a victim of abuse himself and lived this tragic, lonely existence. And he was an absolute musical genius. For some, to quote the Chappelle Show sketch from the time, he made Thriller, man. Thriller. He was just too good of an artist for a lot of fans to take allegations seriously. After he died, it became taboo to speak ill of Michael Jackson. Respect for the dead. And then, This Is It came out. And it created controversy, but certainly not for the reasons you'd think in today's terms. The film was a documentary, meant as a tribute and as a glimpse behind the scenes of the show the world never got to see. It was edited together from hours of footage of preparation and rehearsal. But Jackson was in very rough shape leading up to his death. And according to his family, Michael, the consummate perfectionist in his life, would never have wanted any rehearsal footage released to the public where he wasn't giving 100% of himself to a performance. Yes, that was the entire controversy. It was exploitative. This is not what I was expecting when I wandered into the controversy section on Wikipedia. I've wanted to avoid talking about Michael Jackson. I just ignored talking about it when Balloon Boy came up in week one and I used that drop. Last week on Into the Crevasse, I noticed the first reference to his death.
And you probably don't know this
because you've never played a moonologist, but werewolves only come out at night.
Yes, I remember that from the Thriller video.
Too soon.
Too soon was absolutely the sentiment at this point in 2009. 10 years later, though, we had moved on. Another documentary about Michael Jackson, this one called Leaving Neverland, was released in 2019. There was a different kind of backlash to Leaving Neverland. Radio stations were removing Michael Jackson's music from the airwaves. And then there was backlash to that backlash. The victim statements in the documentary have been put under intense scrutiny. It was this entire other media circus. And then, to much less fanfare, most radio stations added the music back in 5 or 6 months later. The only lasting impact I've found? You still can't find the Season 3 Simpsons episode, Stark Raving Dad, streaming or in syndication. This is an episode where Homer gets institutionalized and meets a man that claims he's Michael Jackson. Jackson himself did voice the character, under a pseudonym for some reason, but he doesn't actually appear as himself in the episode. It's very clearly established at the end that this patient, Leon Kompowski, just talks in Jackson's voice because he found it made people happy. Considering this episode is from 1991, it's very much in line that, at the time, Jackson was more or less considered to just be this eccentric guy who had a chimpanzee and was turning his estate into a theme park. But where do we draw the line between artist and art? I don't have the answer. For me, there's a stark difference between a guest spot on a cartoon and continuing to support that music, which was all Michael. And considering he's dead, we'll never get a resolution on what he did and didn't do. Honestly, what I really take issue with is that they waited 26 years to take a stand on that episode. Fox actually re-aired that episode in 2009 as a tribute to Michael Jackson when he died. So what does this come down to? It's money. It's always money. Our standards as viewers are shifting, and that's great. We should feel uncomfortable. It's a sign of growth. But once you put these things out in the world, I think that we, the individual audience member, should decide for ourselves what is still acceptable and unacceptable. And we'll see this time and time again. And I hate to say it, it's not even going to be the last time in this podcast. That content gets removed will eventually, at some point, be used specifically to advertise the show. And I don't think there's a gray area when it comes to that. This is only episode 3, so you've probably realized that I pick a news story for the olds because it has permeating relevance throughout the rest of the show. Yeah, sorry, we're not done with this yet, but I'm going to put a pin in this and let's lighten things back up again.
This is what everyone watched instead.
As always, let's take a look at the viewer numbers on NBC. Community, 5.3 million. Parks and Rec, 4.8 million. The Office, 8.2 million. 30 Rock, 6.1 million. Pretty steady numbers since last week, and they were up against some stiff competition. Meanwhile, Leno's down a full million viewers, coming in at 4.4 million this week. Leno's main guest was animal trainer Dave Salmoni. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, and I don't really know much about him. He doesn't appear to have anything to do with anyone that was involved in Tiger King, but talking about documentaries changing public opinion, I think that animal trainer that does talk shows doesn't look like a profitable career moving forward. The only thing he's done recently was a virtual appearance in the summer of 2020 on Live with Kelly and Ryan. And holy shit, would I watch that show if it was hosted by Kelly Kapoor and Ryan Howard. Apparently, Leno had another bit he ran every night called 10 at 10, where he'd interview a celebrity and ask them 10 random questions. There's almost none of this surviving on the internet today, except a lot of blog posts about how unfunny his questions were, which is why I've never bothered mentioning it before. But tonight's special, because his 10 at 10 guest was Tina Fey. I wish I could find the list of questions and answers. But I guess some things just weren't worth preserving. Not shockingly, NBC once again lost the night. So let's work our way up. On ABC, Flash Forward had 8.9 million viewers at 8 o'clock. I got nothing specific to say about this episode, but I coincidentally did some digging into the series itself and found this gem. It was co-created by David S. Goyer. He wrote the first draft to 2008's The Dark Knight. His story was an adaptation of a limited series run of Batman comics called The Long Halloween. I swear I wasn't hanging on to that nugget for the Halloween show. If his first draft featured a lot of Batman doing growling narration, then I think we know who to thank for one of the funnier bits later tonight on Community. Grey's Anatomy had 13.7 million viewers. This episode features Mark Saul as intern Steve in one of his over 30 appearances on Grey's. And a very special thank you to my wife and my most loyal listener for explaining to me some of the shenanigans that Steve has gotten up to over the years. Mark Saul would make one appearance in season 3 on Parks and Recreation as the poor Whole Foods employee who tries to offer Ron Swanson veggie bacon. Private Practice had 9.2 million at 10 o'clock. In some very loose crossovers, William Charlton plays prosecutor, and he had a very small part in Park Season 6 New Beginnings, while Leslie Thurston plays nurse, and she'll play waitress in Park Season 4 Lucky. All I needed to read for this episode was the first line from the synopsis on the fandom wiki page. Addison must deal with the return of Naomi's former patients, Zoe and Amelia, whose embryos were accidentally switched. What do you have to say about that, Dr. Spichemin?
Now, full disclosure, most of my experience is putting babies in women.
Over on CBS, Survivor got 12 million viewers, and Liz Kim was voted off the island. Listen, thank God ABC was giving me some good material, because I got nothing to talk about here. CSI was back to new episodes this week, with 15.2 million tuning into Bloodsport. The team investigates the murder of the local college football coach, and the star running back is the main suspect. This would have been perfect fodder if this aired against last week's Community, but sometimes these stars just don't align how I'd like. The Mentalist had a huge night, with 15.5 million tuning in to see Red Scare. Character actor Ron Canada guest stars here, and of his 147 credits on IMDb, he's uncredited as playing Mr. Haskins on The Office Season 9, The Farm. It's likely in the deleted scenes, which aren't on the DVD, and NBC's removing content from YouTube to put it on Peacock, so I don't know, America. Keep your eyes peeled if they ever release this scene. The clear winner tonight was Game 2 of the World Series on Fox, with 18.9 million viewers. The Philadelphia Phillies were back in the World Series, looking to defend their 2008 title. The Yankees were back for the first time since 2003, and they hadn't won since 2000, which was their fourth championship in 5 years. One crucial moment of this game, relevant to this very podcast, came in the bottom of the seventh, when the Phillies' first baseman caught a low line drive, which was ruled a fly out. He then threw the ball to second, where the base runner, who was coming off of first, was tagged, and this was ruled a double play, and it ended the inning. However, on replay, this was a blown call. The full game's on YouTube. This all takes place around 3 hours, 12 minutes, and 45 seconds in. The ball clearly hits the ground just inches before landing in the glove, so neither out should have counted. Why is this one play significant? Because that first baseman is none other than Ryan Howard. We haven't even got to the shows yet, and I've mentioned Ryan twice. Years later, the baseball player would cameo as himself on The Office, and yes, they absolutely make reference to the names. Ultimately, despite the blown call, the Yankees still won Game 2, 3-1, and that evened the series to one game apiece. Had this series gone to 7 games, we would be talking about it next week, since Game 7 would have taken place the following Thursday. But the Yankees managed to win it all the night before, winning the World Series 4-2. Meanwhile, what no one was watching was FX. Always Sunny in Philadelphia had 1.35 million viewers with The Gang Wrestles for the Troops. It's another classic, and this is the first appearance of Travis Schultz's recurring character, Ben the Soldier. And Travis would eventually turn up on Community as a character who is the personification of Subway. Also, the song Kiss from a Rose by Seal was used in this episode, and that also turns up hilariously later in Community. And then only about 900,000 people stuck around after Always Sunny to watch the premiere of The League, a sitcom about a group of friends and their fantasy football league. A show that not a lot of people seem to remember, but I loved it. I'm running super long today, so I'm going to push talking about it into next week because there's so many cast connections between The League and the shows on NBC that it deserves a few minutes of attention. But in relevance to this episode, one of the main cast members was Jean Lajoie, who made it big on YouTube before starring in this show. If you want to hear the hottest of takes on the reaction to Michael Jackson's death, look up his YouTube video, Michael Jackson is Dead, which he released only 2 days after Jackson died. Warning, I try to keep this podcast PG to PG-13, using the same language you hear on these shows. That song is incredibly explicit. But despite its content, I think he makes some valid points that the news did a complete 180 on reporting about Jackson once he had died. So, overall, not a lot of Halloween-y goodness was happening on the other networks. But on NBC, we've got 2 straight hours of costume comedy.
Before we caught up colds and streaming was years away.
Introduction to Statistics is a hard phrase to say and is the second of 3 Community episodes co-written by John Pollock, who also wrote 2 episodes of 30 Rock, and he'll go on to co-create the show Perfect Couples, a sitcom we'll be talking about when we get to the 2010-2011 season. This episode was also co-written by Tim Hobart, And this is the second of his five writing credits, three of which were with John Pollock, while he had sole credit on the other two. This was the first of three episodes Justin Lin directed. I need to correct something I said in episode one when I thought Joe Russo directed the episode Modern Warfare, when in fact, Justin Lin directed Modern Warfare. Joe directed A Fistful of Paintballs and A Few Paintballs More, so that's where my confusion came from. Justin Lin is a legit action movie director, and at the time, he was most famous for having directed The Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift, and then earlier in 2009, Fast and Furious, the fourth movie in the franchise. Forget the Rambo franchise, Abed. Fast and Furious titles never made sense. I've looked at this title a few different ways, and I've been trying to find a second meaning, and I can't find any. I think Introduction to Statistics is just a pretty straightforward reference to meeting Greendale's statistics professor, Michelle Slater. But if I'm missing some sort of double entendre, please let me know. This episode is actually a two-for-one in the holiday department, since Annie has discovered that students can get extra credit for organizing group events, and she's the first student ever to exercise this option, hosting a Dia de los Muertos party, sometimes referred to as Mexican Halloween.
Which is actually quite offensive to people familiar with Mexican Halloween as a sexual position.
You know, that holiday where we honor those that have passed in the last year? Are you sensing why I got to the point where I couldn't avoid talking about Michael Jackson anymore? We're getting a few setups in this cold open that'll play out for the rest of the episode. Anyone who goes to the party will also get extra credit, but Chang's not even going to get paid. Shirley's no longer wearing her wedding ring, and she's excited for the party because she's single and ready to mingle. Pierce is struggling to keep up with his much younger group of friends, claiming he couldn't accept Annie's Evite from his pocket phone. And then he accidentally calls his mom, talks her on speakerphone, and she's asking if that Jeff is still teasing him. Jeff, meanwhile, is teasing Britta and asks her if their fun sexual tension is going to break anytime soon because he has this hot statistics professor and he wants to make a move on her. We meet Professor Slater, who at this point has been the only sane staff member of Greendale Community College. Jeff asks her out after class, but she has a hard rule against dating students, which, yes, even though you and Jeff are the same age, she can't go out with you, Jeff. She's in a position of power. You'd think a good lawyer would know this kind of stuff. Britta's moved on, in the sense that she's never actually even been interested in Jeff in the first place. I had never really put much thought into this before, but Britta's character is so against the pop culture grain. For example, I think back to The Office, in the episode Hot Girl, where Jim goes on a date with the purse saleswoman, Katie, and we get all these shots of Pam looking jealous, just to help drive up the tension of the situation. But here, Britta couldn't care less about what Jeff's doing. Instead, the reaction is pushed to Shirley, who is getting insanely upset on Britta's behalf. Troy and Abed catch Pierce with one of those days of the week pills container, which is used as a bit of a cliche to describe a man in his 70s. But let's be real, at what age did you start needing one of those? To any of the younger listeners out there, that age is a lot lower than you might think. Abed drops some real heavy foreshadowing about mixing pills. Annie is desperate to get Jeff, the only person who won't commit to coming, to actually show up to her party. All of her parties in high school ended when people wanted to get home in time to catch the news. But Jeff has cemented himself as the cool guy, and he'll have the pull to keep people at her party. Annie turns on the waterworks to convince Jeff.
This won't work. The last time you did this, I saved a vial of your tears and have been slowly building up an immunity.
But it does work. Annie's reaction after he agrees to come seems pretty genuine. I don't think those were crocodile tears. It felt a little out of place, but remembering that this is early community, Annie's character still hasn't had the chance to mature out of this kind of reaction. So I guess it kind of makes sense in context. We get to the party, and let's talk about the costumes. Senor Chang's annoyed about everything, and he's dressed as a matador. Shirley begins her long tradition of having costumes that confuse everyone else, since she's dressed as Harry Potter, and everyone thinks she's Steve Urkel. In another tradition, Britta refuses to wear a slutty costume, and she's dressed as an adorable squirrel. Annie, meanwhile, is wearing a skin-tight skeleton costume, in line with her Dia de los Muertos party. Troy is dressed as Eddie Murphy from Delirious. What does that say about Eddie Murphy's outfits when he performs stand-up in the 80s, that they are instantly recognizable as a costume? Abed is the full-on monologuing Christian Bale version of Batman. See, I told you that Dark Knight reference earlier would come back. Pierce comes dressed as the Beastmaster from the 1982 film Beastmaster. He was obviously trying to go for the most virile young stud he can think of, but he makes such a dated reference, and that just makes him feel old again. Jeff shows up, sans costume, because he's just too damn cool, and he's got nothing better to do since Slater is grading papers. Chang has had it with being forced to miss the staff Halloween party, and he tries to rope Jeff into keeping track of who shows up for extra credit. Chang had let it slip that Slater's actually at the same party he's going to. So Jeff bribes Chang to go along with him, and the two ditch Annie's party, which sets Annie on the course for a meltdown. Over at the staff party, the dean is shockingly in a very understated masquerade costume. And that's the last time I'll ever say dean, understated, and costume in the same sentence. Slater's dressed as Robin Hood, and Jeff is now in a full cowboy costume. As Jeff tries to continue to work his charm on Slater, we see something that becomes a trope for this show. The rest of the study group showing up wherever Jeff is, trying to ruin whatever illusion he's trying to create. This time, they're here to bring Jeff back to Annie's party, which has started to fall apart once Jeff left. And Britta reveals a lot of Jeff's character when calling him out on now wearing a costume.
Yippee-ki-yay! Thought you weren't a costume guy.
You had to have one to get in here, squirrel.
Oh, so where did you get it? Because I wouldn't think that any costume stores would be open this late.
I don't know what you're getting at. The words you're looking for are,
I own a cowboy outfit, and it is tight, too. Did you buy it like that? Your toy gun to my head? I'd say yes.
Despite how desperately he's needed at Annie's party, a lot of his persona is really just skin deep, and he's as fragile and lonely and desperate to get accepted as everyone else. Shirley's wild side comes out in this episode, and I'm pretty sure this is the first time we've seen her act like this. Despite the ruckus that everyone else is causing, Shirley is snapping the antenna off of Slater's car, and then tries to flood her office with a garden hose. Britta comes in for the save, and we find out that Shirley's doing some projection. She didn't take her wedding ring off by choice. Her ex-husband asked for it back because it was his mother's, and he wants to give it to his new girlfriend. Shirley's over him, but she's been holding out for the day that he'd come crawling back and she'd say go to hell. But now, it's not going to happen. Shirley calms down, and they head back to Annie's party. But as just one little nod to how Britta may actually feel about the Slater-Jeff situation, she snaps the head off one of Slater's awards. So just as much as Jeff is being superficial, Britta's actions here speak louder than words. Meanwhile, Pierce isn't being superficial at all. He's wearing his emotions on his sleeveless arms, just like that bird. While looking for some solace alone in the bathroom so he can take his medication, he decides to swap pills with the absolute last person in the world you should ever do this with, Starburns, the only other Greendale student who knows who the Beastmaster is. They both start tripping. Starburns is probably getting the better end of the deal.
What did you slip me, man? My heart stopped racing and I can't pee.
But Pierce is tripping hard. Pierce, with a
full-on erection,
is rampaging at Annie's party. Back at the staff Halloween party, Jeff is desperate enough to turn to Chang for advice, and he takes it, and he straight up begs Slater for sex. And it works. The two head off to bang. Is there a more eloquent way to say that? Unfortunately for Jeff, they have to walk by the library, and all hell is broken loose. Jeff tries to stay out of it, claiming that he can't fix Pierce.
Jeff out there, he's the only one who can help!
Because this is around the 17-minute mark of Community, Jeff finally stops being the asshole and heads into the chair force that Pierce has built to talk some sense into him. We get this episode's winger speech, where Pierce learns that he's still got some coolness left in him if he went on a drug trip and built a desk fort. And Abed, who might actually be Batman, swoops in to save the day. Abed gets to close the show out with a meandering speech which reveals how it's actually impossible for Batman to be there to help and be vigilant all at the same time. For as much as Abed likes The Dark Knight, I can't tell if the writers of Community feel the same way. Troy and Abed have been in the tag of pretty much every episode to date, and these have really been Troy's place to shine. Most of these scenes have just been these fun little windows into their blossoming friendship, but they have this weird conversation that leads to them talking about waking up as a donut, and Troy reveals that he'd eat himself.
I wouldn't even question it.
Troy's mostly been in the background this week, but in a throwaway scene here at the end, we get a lot of insight into why Troy and Abed get along so well. Troy, like all of us, has weird thoughts and has never been able to talk to anyone about them before. And now he has that in Abed. And isn't that what real friendship really is? Finding someone to share in those absurd thoughts that pop into your head? Introduction to Statistics definitely gets overshadowed compared to Season 2's Halloween episode, Epidemiology. Those are all really hard titles to say. And I get it. Community's high-concept homage episodes are the landmarks of the series. But episodes like this one anchor this show to allow it to be able to take those big swings later on. There's just so many little interactions between the members of the study group, and they just keep weaving them all together. And this defines the characters themselves and their relationships to one another. And on top of all that, we get great visuals of how they all chose their costumes that just adds even more layers on top. This is what is so great about Halloween episodes.
Happy Halloween.
Greg Pakaitis is the first of 27 Parks and Rec episodes directed by Dean Holland, who would also direct two episodes of The Office, one of those coincidentally being the 2010 Halloween episode Costume Contest. This episode was written by series co-creator Michael Schur. This is only his second writing credit so far on Parks and Rec, the first time since the pilot, and he'd write 18 altogether. He also wrote 10 episodes of The Office, none of which were Halloween themed, but we'll actually see Mike on screen later tonight. One crossover note here is that Cooper Harris appears for the second time as Dr. Harris, a recurring character on Parks and Rec. He was a guest at Phyllis's wedding on The Office, which didn't make the original airing, but I'm sure it will now become a part of the new reality of rewatching The Office on Peacock with those superfan deleted scenes added back in. Now for the uncomfortable part. Louis C.K. is making his fourth of six appearances as Leslie's boyfriend, police officer Dave Sanderson. I loved Louis C.K. He was my favorite stand-up comedian. At this time, he hadn't really blown up yet. His award-winning series on FX, Louis, wouldn't premiere until the following April. So he was still small-time enough that he came to my town on tour in September of 2009. At that show, he took questions from the fans after his set. And I'll never forget this, because someone asked him, what could we see him in? And he joked, if you see me in something, it sucks because I'm a terrible actor. Why am I even bringing this all up? I still don't know how to process Louis C.K.'s sexual misconduct. In some ways, it helps me recognize why some people can gloss over everything about Michael Jackson. Because Louis is a comedic genius. But I can't separate Louis's comedy from what he did. Since 2017, he's been slowly trying to rebuild his career. I haven't seen his latest stand-up special, Sincerely Louis C.K., because you have to buy it from his website. It's a shame you lost $35 million because of all of this, Louis, but I'm not spending money to hear your apology. And really, where I stand here now, it seems to me that Louis doesn't seem to be all that upset about what he did, just that he got called out for doing it. While we're here, let's talk about Aziz Ansari, the other elephant in the room, since I may as well dig deeper into the crevasse since I'm already down here. It's not fair to mention Aziz in the same air as Louis. And it probably wasn't fair to Louis to compare him to Michael Jackson. This is very nebulous, because what Jackson was only accused of doing is so much worse than the terrible things Louis admitted to doing. But the story with Aziz is different. Aziz probably could have hid under a rock for a few years and let the story fight itself out in the public eye. But he didn't do that. He released a stand-up special in 2019 called Right Now. It was released on Netflix, so the only cost was the subscription I pay for anyways. In that special, he gets right down to it. I don't feel like he was putting on an act there. I can feel his remorse. He's processing everything with jokes, which I'm okay with. He addresses the irony that one of his most well-known routines is glorifying yet another monster, R. Kelly. He even addresses how people were very quick to give up on R. Kelly, but not Michael Jackson. And he brings up that Parks and Recreation often had Tom doing things that he probably should have gone to jail for. And that special's been the only thing he's done. Maybe it's because there's not a whole lot going on these days, but Aziz still is not really out in the public. I honestly think Aziz has handled this in the best way possible, and I'm ready to move on from it. So here we are, looking back at a Halloween episode from 2009, and I'm grappling with all this. But this isn't like Stark Raving Dad. This isn't an episode glorifying Louis C.K. He's just a guest star. He's not going to be around much longer. And I don't think you can erase its existence just by his association. And we're going to continue to see problematic behavior from Tom going forward. And to ignore it, along with the fact that it's a performance by Aziz Ansari, feels disingenuous. I hope that this frames us all a bit better moving forward. But we're going to continue to find uncomfortable things. And we'll just have to process it as they come along. That's my stance anyways. I don't believe it's fair to pretend like the things that we know about now never happened. And I wanted to take a few minutes to address it. So with all that shittiness out of the way and out in the open, let's actually talk about this episode of Parks and Recreation. We start off with Leslie hanging out at a high school. Not a good look. And she's waiting for the titular
Red Bacchitis.
Every year, the statue of Mayor Percy in Ramsett Park is defaced on Halloween. And Leslie is convinced that Bacchitis is the kid responsible. And she vows that this year she'll catch him red-handed. Bacchitis, despite what he claims later, is pretty clearly eating a peach here. I mean, right? That's a peach. It's whether it's a peach or a plum like he claims, pretty bold move to eat something juicy like that while standing in the hallway without a napkin. We get the story of Mayor Percy. He bravely ran into a fire at a bakery to save a pumpernickel recipe, which was enough to warrant a statue, even though 30 people died in the fire. Leslie's first solution to protecting Ramsett Park is to hire Andy to work security.
Don't go overboard. Just stop him, by any means necessary.
Nope.
Parks was still a little bit lost with what to do with Andy's character. This is a workplace comedy, after all, and it's centered around the Parks Department. Andy has long outlived his original purpose, so they had to keep finding excuses to keep him in the story. And there's a lot of testing out what would and wouldn't work. They are finally testing out how Andy would work without Anne in the picture. And this episode becomes foundational for the character that Andy would turn into as the show carried on. Meanwhile, back at the Parks Department, Anne shows up to tell everyone that she actually doesn't have to work Halloween this year. In 2009, Matt is feeling this sentiment. So she's throwing a Halloween party. Gotta say, I love the fact that Annie Edison and Anne Perkins are both throwing parties on the same night. Anne specifically doesn't want Tom at her party because Tom's a skeevy pervert. But Jerry being Jerry messed things up and told Tom about the party. Interestingly enough, I don't think Jerry himself is ever seen at the party. And for that matter, neither is Donna. We got just a flash of Donna's brilliance 2 weeks ago in Sister City. And how much longer must we wait to see more of her? It's not addressed here, but April's back from Venezuela. And while I was watching this, I was kind of thinking, did I just imagine that she was gone? But in a sheer coincidence, I was watching the series finale the other day, and April tells Donna, remember when we went to Venezuela for 2 weeks? So I'm not making this all up. Leslie tells Anne she's going to be late for the party because she's all consumed with catching Bacchitis.
Check this out. These are all the possible routes from Greg Bacchitis' house to the statue.
That looks like something you would find on the wall of a serial killer.
In a way, that's a compliment.
From here, we basically have two different stories playing out without much crossover. We see Anne's party and Leslie tailing Bacchitis. Much like Annie, Anne's not that great at throwing parties. But once again, characters are in costumes, so I'm loving it. Anne is a Raggedy Ann doll, which I think is an odd choice because how often do you see a Raggedy Ann costume that's not part of a couple's costume with a Raggedy Andy? It would, of course, be very bizarre to see Mark Brandanowitz dressed up like Raggedy Andy. But after last week's episode, there was this slight hint that Ann may not be full over the non-Raggedy Andy. And while they don't cross paths tonight, I feel like this costume is like this non-subtle hint that this is all still on the back burner. Ron's this vintage swashbuckling style pirate. April's a weird clown, I guess. And her boyfriend Derek is a straight person, while his boyfriend Ben is a more Captain Jack Sparrow-esque pirate, which Ron can appreciate. Mark shows up, originally without a costume, and we learn that Derek knows exactly how to dress like a straight guy because they're dressed the exact same way. Can I be offended by this? I have never worn khakis with a tucked-in button-up. Mark's eventual costume is a custom Brandanowitz Indiana Pacers jersey. Honestly, throwing a jersey on and calling that your Halloween costume is a definite straight guy move. Everyone else at the party are Anne's co-workers, which is painfully obvious because they all just came dressed as doctors and nurses, because they're even lazier than Mark is. This reminds me of going to parties in university and how many people wore their lab coats for a costume. It was an economic choice. You were forced to pay so much money for a lab coat if you had chemistry labs, so why not reuse it for Halloween? Anne's party is a dud.
World's colliding. Always awkward.
April's underage and drunk. She's already pretty upset that they skipped a gay Halloween party to come to this one instead.
Do you know how much fun gay Halloween parties are? Last year I saw three Jonas Brothers make out with three Robert Pattinsons. It was amazing.
Mark realizes that all of Anne's co-workers loved Andy. Dr. Harris is going to leave, presumably to go catch the news, and he's taking a bottle of wine and a book off the bookshelf with him. Just as things are at their worst, Tom makes his appearance. Yes, I just Googled when I'm in Love with a Stripper came out, and that was in 2005. So I wouldn't say the T-Pain costume is topical. Tom's wife Wendy bucks the trend of doctors dressing as doctors, and she's a cowgirl, which would be a great couple's costume if she was married to Jeff Winger. Despite not technically being invited, Tom is the saving grace here and turns the snooze fest into an actual party. With everything in full swing, things are heating up. The nurses are all testing Brandanowitz's loyalty by throwing themselves at him. Wendy, meanwhile, takes the time to thank Ron for not ratting on her green card marriage, a plot point that came up several weeks ago and has been mentioned since. Of course Ron's not going to rat her out.
No worries. I'd hate for you to have to go back to Canada. Oh, that socialized medicine up there.
Suck it, Ron. Canada's great. Anyways, the two have a bit of a moment, and we get to see that Tom is not thrilled to know that Wendy's actually excited for the day they can get divorced without raising any suspicion. Near the end of the party, Mark and Anne, who don't know it's a green card marriage, inadvertently make Tom feel even worse by telling him how cool his wife is, and they can't believe he landed a woman like her. So we're seeing there's a lot more to Tom here, and that he's overcompensating for his real feelings about Wendy by acting out the way that he does. Meanwhile, in the other storyline, over on the other side of town, Leslie and Dave have been tailing Pachytis since he left his house at 7 o'clock, and he's nowhere near Ramsey Park, and he's just skateboarding with his friends. So they call it a bust, and since Andy is guarding the statues anyways, they head back to the parks department, only to find that it has been vandalized, with a pile of shaving cream with a peach pit on top sitting on Leslie's desk as the centerpiece. So they get Pachytis brought in for questioning. Dave's way too caught up with Leslie to be thinking straight, since there's no good reason for him to have Pachytis picked up in the first place, since they are his alibi, but they question him in the parks department. Even then, with no proof, they've got a very short amount of time to get any information out of him before Dave has to let him go. Dave and Leslie can't crack the kid, and that's when Andy comes in from his security detail. In need of a confession, there's only one person you can call in.
My name is Bert Macklin. Yeah. I'm with the FBI.
We meet, for the first time, Andy's alter ego. Unfortunately, Pachytis has Macklin crying almost immediately. Leslie, enraged, brings up the peach pit. But Greg says he was actually eating a plum. Lies. I washed it again. That is definitely a peach. Leslie lets it slip that they were watching him the whole time. That's enough to take all the wind out of the sails of this investigation, and Greg's mother shows up and rips into Dave, Leslie, and Bert Macklin. Dave takes off so he can go tell his shift commander why he illegally detained a teenager, leaving Leslie and Andy to clean up, and they're left to their own devices, which is a bad idea. Leslie believes in innocent until proven guilty, but not in this case, because she just knows Greg did this. With very little recourse, and using Andy Dwyer as a sounding board, Leslie decides to TP Pachytis' home as revenge. While in the act, Dave rolls up on them, and we learn that Andy knows exactly how to deal with the police.
5-0!
With Dave on the scene, the homeowner comes out, telling Dave to arrest them. Except it's not Greg's mother, and Leslie immediately apologizes for getting the wrong house. And then we find out this is actually Greg Pachytis' house, and that's actually his mother. And the kid just hires people off of Craigslist to pretend to be his mom whenever he gets in trouble. Pachytis isn't in his room, meaning he can only be in one other place. And Leslie finally catches him red-handed vandalizing Ramsey Park. All's well that ends well, except they still can't figure out what happened at City Hall, since they were trailing Pachytis since he left home. But, showing just how much of a criminal mastermind he is, we see that he snuck in as a maintenance worker much earlier in the day. And you can actually see him in the background in those early scenes. And at 5:02, when Jerry locks up, Pachytis had free rein to trash the place, leave his peach pit, sneak out, and head back home before they ever started tailing him in the first place. For a really fun Halloween episode, even more of the story arcs are getting pushed ahead. I'm really enjoying the irony that for the first time in 12 episodes, the pit isn't mentioned at all, even though it's actually a lot now, but a peach pit is so central to Leslie's rage. We know there's a ticking clock on Tom's green card marriage, so that'll play into more episodes later on. And Wendy's met Ron Swanson, which is an interesting wrinkle. Mark and Anne's relationship is put through some new tests tonight. And finally, letting Andy run on a story without Anne was a highlight. Most people who love this show don't really fondly remember these early episodes. Some even suggest just skipping season 1 and even season 2 entirely to new viewers coming into the show. But I am thoroughly enjoying this slow burn of watching this show get better each week and stopping to think about it and talk it through. I've never dwelt on these early episodes before, but there's all these pieces slowly being put together. And while I'm just waiting to see the final picture, I'm also really enjoying taking the time to analyze how it's all being put together. I'm glad I ended this section on a high note because that first part was rough to get through. I'm especially glad it ended on a high note because, well, fair warning, things on The Office don't start off too well either. Koi Pond was directed by Reginald Hudlin, his only time directing any of these shows. He was most well known for directing some episodes of Bernie Mac in movies like Ladies Man and, I swear this will come up again, 1990's House Party. This was the second of 7 episodes co-written by the duo of Warren Lieberstein and Halstead Sullivan. Warren is brother of the now current Office showrunner and Toby Flenderson himself, Paul Lieberstein. And Warren would cameo in season 7 as Toby's brother, Rory Flenderson. I never fully understood their connection to Greg Daniels, but I finally Googled it, and I've learned that Warren and Paul's sister, Suzanne, has been married to Greg since 1991. Warren himself was married to Angela Kinsey from 2000 to 2010. Halstead, meanwhile, doesn't appear to be married or related to anyone else on the series. Going through our crossovers, one of the receptionists is played by Jennifer Hastie, will show up in a few weeks' time on Leslie's House on Parks, and Tom Yee plays Tim Dockery, and he'll show up in a few months' time as Senior Chang's brother. So if you've only ever watched this show on Netflix, you may be wondering, how is this a Halloween episode? After season 2's Halloween, which was an early classic, we don't get another proper full Halloween episode until season 7. Season 5's employee transfer has this amazing cold open with Kevin, Creed, and Dwight all dressed as the Joker from The Dark Knight. Have I brought up that movie enough yet tonight? But that's just the opener, and the rest of that episode takes place on a different day. Koi Pond did the same thing. It had a Halloween-themed cold open, and then the rest of the episode played out on not Halloween. Had a cold open is the key phrase here. So basically, the warehouse has been turned into a haunted house, and Daryl, wearing a pumpkin costume, is pushing a group of kids around on a cart. Michael is dressed like one of the guys from the Dick in a Box Saturday Night Live sketch. Great choice for a kids' party, Mike. Michael welcomes the kids and promises to scare them. And the rest of this scene plays out that Daryl can't recognize anyone's costume, and he's annoyed that no one gave him a list of who they actually all were. So going through the costumes, we have Aaron as Princess Fiona from Shrek, Angela as a Black Widow spider, Kevin's Paul Blart Mall Cop, Oscar's dressed as Sarah Palin, and Kelly is Lilu from The Fifth Element, the last of which Daryl thinks is a burn victim. Treed's dressed as a traditional vampire, while Ryan is dressed like Edward from Twilight. He says Creed's not with the current trend of vampires, although considering how April had seen three Robert Pattinsons the year before at a gay Halloween party, Ryan's not being too topical himself. Phyllis is a witch. Stanley looks to be sitting in something like an electric chair, but he's just doing his crossword puzzles. And Pam's barely seen in the background as Rosemary from Rosemary's Baby. Daryl thinks Meredith is the old crone from Drag Me to Hell, but she's just a hobo. Andy is also barely seen in the background, but he's dressed as Thriller-era Michael Jackson, which, for obvious reasons, was a popular costume choice in 2009. Jim, lazy as always, has the word book written on his face, leading Daryl to call him Bookface.
Yes, I am the popular social networking site known as Bookface.
Cousin Mose is standing in front of some boxes. So even though Michael Shorer wrote tonight's Parks episode, he had 10 minutes of free time to swing over to the office set to just stand there. He's not even wearing a Halloween costume. Dwight, however, has gone all out, as usual, and he's dressed as Billy the Puppet from the Saw movies, but he tells Daryl that he's Jigsaw, idiot. Does any of this sound familiar? Have you seen this before? There's a good chance that you haven't, because of what happens next. We cut to Michael simulating hanging himself, and the kids are legitimately terrified. Michael then gives a speech that suicide is never the answer, leaving Daryl in shock, asking, "What the hell is wrong with you?" I brought up all the episodes from all these shows that have since been removed from streaming services in my very first trailer episode, and we'll get to those when we have to. I also brought up Stark Raving Dad today because of this scene, and it all dovetails into everything else I brought up today. There was an apparent outrage over this cold open. How, specifically, is a little unclear after all these years. It must have been the old-fashioned calls to the network kind of outrage, because I've read as many reviews as I could find of this episode, and this scene barely gets a blip on the radar. Every single article I could find about outrage is from 2019 or later. I found one review of the DVD box set from 2010, which mentions the cold open is now gone. It doesn't really say much more about it. Whatever this outrage was, it has not been archived on the internet. Because, unlike The Simpsons waiting 28 years to stop airing Stark Raving Dad, this happened immediately. The Office was already in syndication at this point, and the cold open was cut from reruns right away. It's not on the DVDs, it's not even in the bonus features or any of the deleted scenes. It is one of the most stupid things Michael has ever done, and this very well could be a line that was just not to be crossed. Who am I to judge? For years, though, this was just a lost scene. But a few years ago, NBC started loading all sorts of extras onto YouTube as a way to advertise for NBC.com. A lot of the stuff from the DVDs, deleted scenes, blooper reels, they all started showing up on YouTube, including this lost scene in full. And it's only been removed recently. Because it was up on YouTube less than 2 months ago when I started working on this podcast. Because I found the clip, and it was being used as an ad. A scene too controversial to ever be seen again was now being used to drive traffic to NBC's website. Does that make you feel scummy? Because I don't like it. It's gone now, along with a lot of the content that had been on YouTube. Once The Office was pulled from Netflix, all this stuff started disappearing to drive people to Peacock to be able to see it. I was only able to find it because you can find it in some best of the Halloween on The Office fan compilations, but who knows how long those will stay up before they get copyright strikes. There's a valid debate about what we do with this content after the fact. Is it too offensive? Should we just leave it as is? I don't know. These are ultimately artistic works, meant to evoke a response. And black humor evokes a response. What's messed up, though, is that they reversed their decision years after the fact to dangle this in front of fans as lost content for advertising. As lost content for advertising. Daryl said it best. What the hell is wrong with you? So as much as I want this podcast to be about trying to capture the moment in time this first aired, I can't really tell you for sure how this episode originally aired. Netflix and the DVDs have a full 22-minute long episode, so something in this episode, as we watch it now, got pulled out of the deleted scenes to pad this episode back to a full length. And the cold open, as it exists now, just basically picks up where we originally would have picked up after the credits. And it's co-manager Jim preparing to speak to a client and finding out that they want Michael to come along too. Jim's upset that Michael is micro-co-managing him. Just the fact that Jim had to use that sentence should help him realize that this whole co-manager idea is really weird. Michael and Jim return from the meeting, and Michael is soaking wet, claiming that he got caught in a rainstorm that Jim somehow managed to escape. Jim, for what we believe is altruistic reasons, will not tell the rest of the office what happened. But as Michael is returning from the bathroom, having changed into Jim's spare suit, Aaron gets a phone call that Michael's keys were found in a koi pond.
Did you say koi pond?
After a lot of badgering from the staff, we learn that Michael fell into a koi pond on his way out of the meeting. The bullpen is having a field day teasing Michael about it, mocking him with all sorts of wordplay. Jim, while not saying anything, is loving it because of how much crap Michael had given him before they left. Michael's having a hard time dealing with this.
I'm not usually the butt of the joke. I'm usually the face of the joke.
Fed up with all this bullying, Michael brings everyone into the conference room. He's already lost control because they're all pissed about how much he bullies all of them. Michael decides to create a do not mock list to find everything that's off limit for jokes. We learn, amongst many things, that this is the second time Michael's fallen into a fountain. Dwight thinks his nose is too small. And Meredith has had sex with a terrorist. After learning that Michael has killed a fish and he needs to pay $300 to replace it, Jim finally steps in and sends everyone back to work. Jim's trying to calm Michael down and suggests that he should try some self-deprecation to defuse the situation. That backfires when we learn how sad Michael's life actually is. Talking about things that stung back when I first watched this episode, much like Anne having to work every single Halloween, I, much like Michael, couldn't think of 5 phone numbers the first time I got a cell phone with a 5 friends plan. Am I oversharing here?
Too far! God!
Michael, meanwhile, realizes how his plan has backfired, and now he's even more pissed off at Jim for talking him into this. Big news, though. Meredith is going to get the security camera footage of Michael falling into the koi pond through her roommate. The bigger news here is that Meredith has a roommate. Could you imagine having Meredith Palmer as your roommate?
Ugh.
Jim's trying to stop this, and again, you think he's being managerial and doesn't want the staff picking on Michael. Threats of forcing everyone to stay late doesn't work, and everyone gathers around to watch the footage, including Michael. Jim is really trying to stop it, but Michael, not done undermining him.
It's okay, watch it. He can't fire all of you.
They all watch, and Oscar immediately catches something, leading Jim into a panic. They rewind the video, and it's clear as day that Jim could have saved Michael, but instead, he dodges out of the way. Michael and Jim hash it out, and Jim tells Michael that he was upset that Michael wouldn't let him do the job on his own. So despite everything that happened today, Michael's main takeaway is that he's pleased to learn that Jim is actually jealous of him. And in the end, we're left with Jim and Michael to bond over the office making fun of them both. Dwight's subterfuge of Jim was pretty low-key this week, but to Dwight's pleasant surprise, Jim has turned out to be his own worst enemy.
And the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So Jim is actually my friend. But because he is his own worst enemy, the enemy of my friend is my enemy. So actually, Jim is my enemy. But.
Meanwhile, there's an entire B-plot that happens outside of all of this, with Andy and Pam being forced to go do cold call sales in Wilkes-Barre since they are the lowest performing salespeople at the branch. They're already on edge from the jump when Pam won't let Andy finish his song.
Now my head hurts. Feels like I held in a sneeze.
At their first meeting, they're confused for a married couple which Pam immediately shuts down. So, much like Jim, she too is dealing with a buffoon, but learns very quickly that that doesn't just give her a license to be mean. At the second meeting, this time Andy's getting payback, claiming that he dates face models, and Pam is only the surrogate for their baby, since it doesn't matter what she looks like. This sale falls apart too, and now they're really fighting, with Pam upset that Andy was so much meaner than she was, and it was on purpose. Andy, in his defense,
I was never going to make that sale.
So, third tries the charm, this time with them both deciding to improvise being a couple. It goes remarkably well, because Andy actually knows about all the good birthing coaches in town. Andy takes it way too far, becoming even more bizarre and getting way too close to Pam's stomach. They debrief in the car afterwards. Andy reveals some vulnerability here, saying that he was ready for marriage and children, but everything's just been falling apart. He's just desperate for a girlfriend and got caught up in playing the fantasy. Andy confesses that he has a crush on Aaron, and Pam encourages him to go for it because, you know, this is a TV show and Andy can only date one of his coworkers. Back at the office, Pam tells Aaron that the day was a waste of time in trying to get sales, but she throws Andy a bone by telling Aaron that she had a lot of fun hanging out with Andy all day. I don't want to keep harping on having the cold open change, but the pacing in this episode gets a little weird, and I feel like that confirms my suspicions about padding the episode out with deleted scenes. Also, after last week's huge blowout, Pam and Michael are kept physically separated in this entire episode. I'm starting to notice, watching these slowly and week over week, they leapfrog arcs. The major plots of Dwight trying to take Jim down and Michael dating Helene are glossed over to focus instead on other conflict between Jim and Michael. This episode almost becomes something of a return to the foreground for Andy. He's been used sparingly since, really, the middle of season 5 and his breakup with Angela. He's been parts of other people's stories, and sometimes he gets the focus of the C storyline, but that's about it. Andy's interest in Aaron hasn't even really been brought up since Niagara, but it's coming back strong. We have to remember, Ed Helms is fresh off a summer blockbuster success with The Hangover, so it's a little strange it's taken several episodes before they started trying to use Andy more. It'll be interesting to watch the progression of more Chang on Community with more Andy on The Office. In retrospect, and thinking to later seasons when they would really try to push all the major storylines in every episode, it's interesting to see how they're maneuvering back and forth between these plot lines. And there's a bit of a throwaway bit at the start of the episode, but Pam having the lowest sales in the branch would also begin to influence her storyline as well. All right, well, I think it's time to see how the reviews went. Oh, I haven't even started in on 30 Rock yet. Stone Mountain is, once again, directed by 30 Rock mainstay Don Scardino, who directed the premiere season 4. This is John Riggi's 8th of 10 writing credits, and he's also directed 15 episodes, and also had a cameo as Ilio on Hey Baby, What's Wrong? Stone Mountain, as we'll come to learn, is Kenneth's hometown, but it is, by no coincidence, Donald Glover's hometown. I need my 30 Rock superfans out there to let me know if we knew the name of Kenneth's hometown before this episode. I'd just like to know if Donald Glover threw this in as a detail himself while he worked on the show, or if the staff worked it in as an inside joke after he left. I'd imagine he'd probably talk about his hometown a lot, and sorry Stone Mountain, but your town is a pretty good name for a hick town. It's not like my own hometown has a better name, and we don't even have a fatty fat sandwich ranch. In our list of crossovers, Betty White cameos as herself. In December of 2009, a petition was started on Facebook to have Betty White host Saturday Night Live, which started something of a renaissance in her career, including appearances in season 2 of Community as anthropology professor June Bauer. Impressively, it looks like 30 Rock was ahead of the curve on this one. So the hunt for a new cast member continues, and Liz is so worn out from life on the road that she's using a scented candle in her office as a stick of deodorant. Jack wants a status update, and Liz says she's been to San Francisco and Toronto's next. But Jack puts his foot down. Middle American humor is what he's going for. I'm not sure how meta this is, since the last hour and a half has taken place in Colorado, Indiana, and Pennsylvania. And I realize Scranton isn't exactly middle America, but those other two shows aren't exactly getting the ratings that Jack is looking for. But Jack comments that he wants broad humor that everyone can get, and Lutz comes in with a tray of pudding and falls down, and we're left hating ourselves for laughing at it. Jack ends up talking to Kenneth about his hometown, Stone Mountain. Kenneth tells him that every night, the folks go down to the Chuckle Hut. It's a pig rendering plant.
You see, the chuckle is the part of the pig between the tail and the anus.
That, after hours, gets turned into the Laugh Factory. Jack tells Liz to cancel Toronto. They're going to Stone Mountain. Two references tonight telling people not to go to Canada. Screw you too, Jack. While Jack and Liz are off gallivanting, it's almost Halloween in Studio 6H. Jenna's still lashing out about the new cast member. And her latest power move is fighting with the writers and burning scripts. She refuses to be pushed aside.
Like that time at my sister's funeral.
Kenneth suggests that she could get a lot further being nice to the writers instead. Frank, Toofer, and Lutz are preparing for Halloween. We flash back to last year. Frank's dressed as himself with costume written on his hat. Lutz is Boba Fett. And Toofer is dressed as Kid from Kid and Play, stars of the film House Party, directed by Reginald Hudlin, who directed The Office. Listen, I've never seen this movie. I've never heard a Kid and Play song, but I recognize that haircut. And after spending a lot of time looking for any connections between Reginald and these other shows, I squeaked with delight when I saw Toofer's costume. Frank's goal for Halloween is just to see girls in slutty costumes. Do you think that, when Britta was young and lived in New York, she wore something skimpy on Halloween and ran into Frank, and that was the real turning point in her life? Anyways, Frank loves Halloween because everything is upside down and backwards and good becomes evil, and then they get really freaked out when they find out that Jenna's baking them cookies to get on their good side. Jenna won't leave them alone, and they use this as an opportunity to try and prank her. But then Jenna's gay friends show up, and according to Sari, she's going to be going to their gay Halloween party since they're always the best. April Ludgate would agree. Frank, Lutz, and Toofer realize that getting into gay Halloween is their ticket for meeting hot girls. And now we have the boys sucking up to Jenna, with Frank suggesting they merge the parties. Jenna, still trying to impress the writers, agrees. Once Frank's out of sight, Jenna's friend Sasha uses a look of indignation that explains exactly what's going on here. And now the ruse is back in Jenna's favor. And we get to the Halloween party, and the only costume of note here is Cerise's Italian senator costume, which is just her in a bikini. I cannot remember what this is in reference to. I've rooted around. Some people think it's a reference to a porn star who was elected to Italian parliament in the 80s and continued to make adult films while she was a politician, but that's neither topical or something Cerise would even understand. Looking this up, I'm realizing that a lot of Italian politicians used to be bikini models, but nothing of note had happened around 2009, and I couldn't find any senators. So while Italian senator bikini is a fun Google image search, ultimately didn't give me a good answer on this one. Jenna finally calls out the writers, and they come to a peace agreement. The boys can stay, but they can't make fun of Jenna's outdated references anymore.
Are we cowabunga on this?
Down in Stone Mountain, Jack and Liz debate whether or not these small towns represent core American values. Liz has a pretty solid worldview.
I believe that all anyone really wants in this life is to sit in peace and eat a sandwich.
What a surprise. Your worldview is food-based.
Unfortunately for Liz, she eats a carp po' boy with extra chuckle. Hopefully Michael didn't step on that carp first, but that's the least of Liz's troubles. As they get to the hotel, and the desk clerk is way too chatty, and Liz just needs to get the room key to get to a toilet. The chuckle doesn't stay down, and Jack brings Liz some Pepto Bismol that the desk clerk had gone out to get for her, even though she was rude, because these are good people. Liz doesn't trust Jack alone at the Laugh Factory, but she's way too sick to even move. We get to see what passes for comedy in Stone Mountain, and it's Jeff Dunham. I mean, Rick Wayne, and his puppet, Pumpkin. Big night if you were a Jeff Dunham fan. His own show was on at 9 o'clock on Comedy Central, and then here he is guest starring on 30 Rock. Jack enjoys the act, along with several members of the Parcell family who are also seated in the audience. Jack finds Liz in the morning, tell him what she would have heard on the news anyways.
Local funny man and sub shop owner Rick Wayne has been hired by a Catholic
to appear on TGS with a black fella.
Jack and Liz get into a fight, with Jack saying that Liz, and I suppose he's speaking directly to me, just can't see past the Southern ventriloquist act. Liz, meanwhile, needs to convince Jack that some Southerners are charming, but just as many of them are dirtbags like New Yorkers. So now that Liz has passed most of the chuckle, they get back to the Laugh Factory, and Liz decides to heckle Rick Wayne to give him a test of what New York crowds can be like. Pumpkin fires back hard, and Jack can't believe that he could be so mean. Jack learns an important lesson here, that the accents don't mean that they are all salt-of-the-earth kind of people, and that deep down they can be just as mean as New Yorkers are. Jack ends up decapitating Pumpkin, and his head lands on yet another Parcel family member. Jack fires Rick Wayne on the spot, leaving him and Liz to flee Stone Mountain for good. Meanwhile, in the third storyline tonight, Tracy has found out that Fred Dawkins, the obese man who was the inspiration for Pac-Man, and Jugbert Cody, famed clog dancer, have both died, and he gets wound up about the rule of threes, that celebrity deaths always come in threes. You can find numerous examples of this, going back to the summer of 2009 when Farrah Fawcett and Michael Jackson died on the same day and Ed McMahon had died 2 days earlier. Tracy's strategy is to go on the offensive. If a third celebrity dies, then he'll be safe. So first, he calls Betty White and tries to spook her to death. Betty White is incredible here.
But I am going to be at your funeral.
I will bury you.
Then, Jimmy Fallon wanders into Tracy's dressing room, as he's lost trying to find his own set. Tracy doesn't even recognize him, and Fallon mentions that he did a movie with Queen Latifah, which makes him a celebrity in Tracy's eyes. Finally, a joke I can explain the context behind. Fallon left SNL in 2004. Unlike Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, who both left the Weekend Update desk for immediately bright futures, it was 5 years before Jimmy Fallon was hired to replace Conan O'Brien on Late Night when he moved up to take over The Tonight Show from Leno. That movie with Queen Latifah had tanked hard, and Fallon was basically written off in Hollywood for a very long time. Getting hired to do Late Night was seen as a very weird choice at the time, but he quickly found an audience, and the rest is history. So seeing this still unconfident Jimmy Fallon is really a joke that could only exist in this very moment in time. Tracy ends up luring Jimmy backstage and tries to kill him, but Kenneth shows up to talk some sense into Tracy. It turns out, much like Betty White, Jimmy is also worried about the rule of three and is trying to kill Tracy as well. They come to an uneasy truce, and Jimmy decides,
some celebrity doesn't die soon. I'm gonna kill my first guest tonight. It's a dog who plays soccer.
Really? That's your first guest?
Yeah.
In the end, Tracy is left watching the gay Halloween party, and he's down in the dumps because he's too scared to participate. But Kenneth lets him know the breaking news. Pumpkin, the ventriloquist dummy, has tragically died. With a third celebrity death, Tracy is now safe to celebrate. He rips off his shirt and yells,
tell my wife I went to Philadelphia on business! Yeah!
Obviously, these shows are filmed a few weeks in advance, but it would have blown my mind if he said he was going to Philly to watch the World Series. Another really fun Halloween episode here. I think after the last couple weeks, the jokes certainly weren't as dense as they have been, and that's not a bad thing. This episode was really tightly plotted out without becoming overcomplicated. We got more out of the Twofer Lutz Frank trio, which I really enjoy. The writing staff at TGS are a really great repertoire of characters to pull from when the plot needs them. Interestingly enough, other than Kenneth kickstarting all the storylines, he really only sticks around with Tracy in this episode. We actually don't see the stories intersecting a whole lot, but all three do coalesce into that final scene. It works here, and especially after really having to deconstruct the last two episodes to figure out what was going on, this story is a lot more straightforward, and I don't think it suffers because of it. Betty White and, surprisingly, Jimmy Fallon are the show stealers here. And once again, we have Jack standing in for actual NBC leadership. We'll continue to see NBC make bad decisions as the year goes on. And this entire episode seems to be a warning as to what can happen if you let the brass make decisions without input from the creatives. So it should be said that I write out my own thoughts on these shows before checking the reviews, just to make sure their opinions don't flavor my own. Considering how all of last week's episodes were rated, reviewing these episodes should be really interesting.
Reviews.
So again, and I think going forward, I'm just going to be sticking with the AV Club and IGN since I'm getting reviews published from the time and they're giving actual measurable scores to compare. I'm also going to start keeping track of the reviewers' names since I want to see if that affects the scores. Introduction to Statistics got an A- from the AV Club's Emily Todd Vanderweff. After a string of B reviews, this episode was finally good enough to get an A-. The reason being that Community is finally doing episodes that we all know it's capable of. But she calls out that the episode is full of jokes and the storylines are incredibly strong. The reviewer gives an apology to Troy after claiming last week that he wasn't funny enough, because he does such a great job here. Also, Abed's Batman impression is given kudos, since it starts out kind of annoying and then becomes endearing as they continue to rip on The Dark Knight, without referencing Heath Ledger, which had been the thing to do last year. Also, there's a lot of astute observations that Annie and Britta are not really the characters we expected them to be based off our first impressions. Jonah Krakow at IGN gave the episode an 8. The stronger score comes from the fact that the show is moving in a direction, and that direction seems to be rooted in stories that revolve around Jeff. While watching the episode, I thought that this might actually give it some better scores since it's very much a Jeff-centric episode, and these reviews are confirming it. Like the AV Club, everybody is happy that Jeff and Britta seem to be moving in a less than traditional direction and quite possibly might get scrapped altogether. The rest of the enjoyment depends on how much you can tolerate Chevy Chase's physical comedy. Ultimately, the big marks come from the ending here, with Jeff doing the right thing and turning Slater down to help his friends. Jeff coming to his senses are how these last few episodes have all ended, but I guess this is the first time he's given up getting laid, which is somehow more important. Matt Fowler of IGN gave Greg Pakaitis an 8.6, calling it the best conceived and most hilarious episode to date. And he's finally gotten something meaty now that he's out of the pit. And while Leslie and Tom had been a really funny dynamic, the Leslie and Andy pairing has such great potential. Anne's party, meanwhile, is a little bit of a drag, but it's filled with tons of little character moments. I get where this review is coming from, where they haven't seen where the show is going. These little character moments are what help the show grow further down the line, but here and now, it's just an awkward Halloween party. Something that I guess is probably a lot better on a rewatch, but to avoid spoilers, Fowler does pick up on quite a few of the teases that will turn into story arcs through the rest of the season. The AV Club Steve Hesler scored Parks and Rec a B+, so we're getting a lot of consensus here between the two different sites. Specifically, he calls out Leslie taking the mundane to the extreme, like her fascination with the Pakaitis. Obviously, we've seen 12 episodes of Leslie focus on the pit, so of course she's going to hyper-focus on this kid too. Emily Todd Vanderwerf also reviewed Koi Pond for the AV Club, and she scored it a B. So the cold open is basically brushed aside, with the only comment being that Michael's gag is too stupid even for Michael. But whatever the original cut was, the episode was always a little plodding, without very high stakes, which has been the norm for The Office outside of the wedding. This review is quite honestly pretty amazing at predicting where the show was going. This is a story in the arc about Jim becoming Michael, seemingly stating that everything that's been going on has been positioning The Office to be ready for when Steve Carell would leave for the inevitable movie stardom. I'm impressed because if there were rumors about this at the time, I haven't seen them anywhere else. Is this a spoiler? At this point, I can't imagine it is, but Steve Carell would leave The Office at the end of season 7. And we only knew at the very end of season 6 that this was about to happen. So what we're witnessing here is everything we missed about Michael's rise to regional manager in the first place. He probably was a well-liked coworker, but his need to be liked became his downfall as a boss. And we're starting to see Jim's flaws exposed as he's becoming a leader. Dan Phillips of IGN gave Koi Pond a 7. Basically, all this episode is just a slow burn to the conclusion that Jim is to blame for Michael falling in the Koi Pond. Ultimately, it kept seeming like the show was going to build to something funnier than what we eventually got with Michael's dip. The whole episode seems to be holding back on jokes. We don't know why Michael is soaked for several minutes. We don't understand why Jim is so protective of Michael after being so upset with him. When you finally get these reveals as the episode progresses, the payoff doesn't really justify the build. Leonard Pierce of the AV Club gave Stone Mountain a C. AV Club is going scorched earth on 30 Rock, so it'll be interesting to see if these reviews climb at all as the show continues on. The main complaint, and I'll give them the benefit here saying it's a valid one, is that 30 Rock has slid into gags rather than character development. Now granted, this is how I've always kind of seen 30 Rock anyways. Ultimately, when I get the chance, I need to go back and revisit those first three seasons more closely and try to understand why AV Club is tearing apart the show now. I'm not shy about it. Ranking these four series, I put 30 Rock in fourth place. And maybe that's why I'm not so harsh on these early season four episodes, because I never really put it on a pedestal like these critics have been doing up until this point. IGN and Robert Canning were a lot more forgiving, scoring this an 8.8, once again the highest score of the night. But this Middle America versus New York runner is starting to wear thin. Tracy and Jenna continue to just deliver on one-liners, and Jimmy Fallon and Betty White make great guest appearances. It's a review from 12 years ago, and it has the subtitle, Betty White Will Bury Us All. She just might at this point. This episode ranks a little bit lower than the first two, since rather than presenting on something topical and leaving us to make our own opinion, the show is really trying to push its own agenda. And I'm glad I read that final point, because this week's episode was a struggle. What I've left in this episode compared to all the thoughts I've had around it was a real challenge. I'm not here to tell you what things you should or shouldn't be upset about, but I don't want to gloss over them and pretend that I'm fine with seeing Louis C.K. either. I don't have an agenda, and I don't want to sway your opinion on any of these people or the scenes or episodes that have since been removed from these shows. But I chose to create this podcast knowing full well what I'd be dealing with. I don't want to ignore sensitive topics, which is what I've been doing. I don't even look a week in advance to see what episodes are coming up, because I'm trying to stay authentic to the original viewing experience. For the past two episodes, my first drafts have mentioned Michael Jackson's death, and I've cut them both out because I didn't want to talk about it. And then ultimately, I couldn't find any other news stories to talk about in this episode other than a documentary about his final days becoming the number one movie at the box office. When I did my catch-up in the very first episode, I realized that Louis C.K. was going to be a guest character that I'd have to address. Again, I thought maybe I'd say a few words and then just brush it off. But I didn't realize how big of a part he'd play in Greg Pakaitis. And again, maybe I'm just pulling connections out of thin air, but I've been ignoring all this stuff for weeks now, to the point where they fell into one place on one night. And I hope it doesn't overshadow what happened on screen, because this is probably the strongest night we've seen so far. It's weirdly strange to say this, but The Office is actually the weakest link in the four shows tonight. It is the only episode not to stick to Halloween throughout, and maybe that could have made it better, rather than this strange story of Michael falling into a koi pond. It's really the only dull spot here, as Community, Parks, and 30 Rock have offered up some of their best episodes so far this season. If we're doing a costume contest, best costume of the night, I gotta give it to Troy's Eddie Murphy. Consolation prize goes to Jim for Bookface. And if I can put a bow on all of this mess as best as I can, I can't help but thinking about Michael falling into that koi pond. He says it himself. He knew it was there. As beloved as these shows are, I knew damn well what I was getting into, and that at some point I need to talk about these subjects. Yes, it sucks that while so much of these shows are so great, there's an edge to them all that makes you wince when you're looking back. Who knows how much further we'll progress 10 more years down the line, and maybe we'll completely have moved beyond these shows. But for now, as much as I thought I could avoid uncomfortable subjects, I should have known better, because the entire time I've known that Koi Pond was going to be episode 3, and here I am. I've walked right into it, and I'm soaking wet. So, this is the moment where I finally sneak a peek at what's going to happen next week. I'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about November 5th, 2009, with Community's Home Economics, Park and Recreation's Ron and Tammy, The Office's Double Date, and 30 Rock's audition day. What happened in the news? Well, I haven't looked that far ahead yet, but holy crap, I hope I'm not jinxing myself and hoping that it can't be worse than tonight. Meanwhile, I'd love to get some feedback on this episode and to hear how you feel about all this crap that I brought up today. You can always email me at comedynightpodcast@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter at Comedy Night Pod 1 or Instagram at Comedy Night Podcasted Right. Reddit's also the new hot thing too, with the subreddit at reddit.com/r/ComedyNightPodRight, and I can be found as user Comedy Night Podcast. I want to thank you so much for listening, however you found the show so far. It's a slow, slow process, but I'm honestly just trying to put the work in now and hope that it pays off down the line. I don't know who you are, but for the future record, having 6 people download the latest episode on release day is, and I'm being completely genuine, is such a thrill. I'm also seeing trends that people are finding the first episode and continuing through the catalog. So whether you're listening to this on day 1 and now you have to wait 2 weeks, or if you found this in the future and you've just started your binge, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for going on this journey with me. Comedy Night Podcasted Right is researched, written, recorded, produced, edited, performed by me, Matt Cale. I wrote and performed the songs. Outside of the screen caps from Community Parks and Rec, The Office, and 30 Rock, all artwork associated with the podcast is also created by yours truly. If you reach out to the show on social media or Reddit, you are interacting with me directly. Listing off all those credits I've just mentioned, I want you to know that this is absolutely a labor of love. And maybe I'm just saying this to remind myself after having a really tough time getting through this episode. And outside of just putting the show together and working a real life full-time job, and in working on promoting the show, I've also gotten to interact with all sorts of podcasters out there on social media. I'm listening to all sorts of different shows I probably never would have before. Some of them are great. Some are not. That being said, if you're liking what you're hearing and want to get involved, I've got 6 whole listeners. So hit me up and maybe we can find some ways to collaborate and spread our listenership. Jack, I don't think they like this idea. We better get out of here before things turn ugly.
To the Kia Sorento!